This talk was given at Insight Meditation South Bay. For more information and a schedule of our events, visit the Insight Meditation South Bay website at www.imsb.org. For information about online programs, visit the Bodhi Courses website at www.bodhicourses.org. Bodhi is spelled B-O-D-H-I.
So we're at the end of this series of the five faculties, and the fifth faculty, the culmination of the faculties list in a way, although they're all continuing to be important all the way through our lives, is the faculty of wisdom. It's really beautiful to me to look at it in the context of being a faculty. Because, you know, it's not a wisdom, what is that? It's not a static pile of information, something you've learned. It's not facts. It's not a fixed set of rules to live by, much as my mind likes to compile those kind of things. It's not that. It's a potential, and it's an ongoing capability that's in each of us. So it arises out of what we learn from experience, direct experience in our lives. It's both wide and deep, in a way that really transforms the deepest layers of our understanding and our motivation, in a way that really influences how we actually act and respond moment to moment. Tanisaro Bhikkhu Tanjef, he translates this word panya in Pali. He translates it as discernment. I really appreciate this word, and I'll use that a lot in the talk, because it points to how this faculty functions. That the faculty is not a static, our whole minds, our whole being is not a static thing. It's not some understanding that you get once and then you have. But it's this component of how you navigate your life in an ongoing way. So what is it wise that we can learn to discern? In terms of the five faculties, to begin with, looking back over that list, discerning wisdom, the more it deepens, it then feeds back and influences and enriches all of the other faculties. It needs to be present to some degree to even begin to cultivate them, and then it gets richer and richer. So what is it fruitful and transformative to have faith in? How do we really deepen that without learning for ourselves what works? You know, the more it works, the more we have faith in it. So that's wisdom and faith working together. How to make wise effort, how to balance your energy. Nobody can tell you that. You know, you need to, they can try, we do all the time, but you have to see for yourself and really feel, what does it feel like to be over-agitated or over-calm, you know? So you're learning this directly. Mindfulness is, in a way, a training in discernment, right? Especially in terms of the four foundations of mindfulness. You're learning to attune to experience from those points of view. The body as the body, the feeling tone of pleasant and unpleasant in itself. So we begin to discern physical from mental experience. That's one of the first insights in insight meditation. You know, the actual direct sensation of tingling and heat, whatever it is in your hand, is not the same thing as the idea of hand, let alone my hand, let alone, oh dear, I'm getting arthritis, and blah, 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 you know. But there's this direct tingling sensation. So then what kind of mind states are present, and how are they influencing? All this is wisdom to discern in this particular way that the Buddha talked about. The difference between getting caught up in the content of experience versus staying in touch with this, what we might call the phenomenological view or the process view, that, gee, this is an interesting mind-body process that's happening right now. And then we can begin to see when clinging and grasping and pushing is getting in there, and what's the effect of that. So all the time we're looking at how these processes of mind are working to increase or decrease suffering. And that's the essence of the Buddha's view of wisdom. And then discernment is needed to practice concentration, right? The whole process of steadying our focus and deepening our concentration on our concentration object, it depends on discerning more and more subtly what's a distraction and what's spacing out and going to sleep and are we on it, to what degree are we on it. That's the wise discernment. And then the serenity, the calm, and the happiness that can arise as concentration deepens, it's very wise to recognize that clearly and to begin to see, oh, this is satisfying. You know, this is more satisfying than being distracted or falling asleep. So then that comparing mind, we often put down comparing mind in this practice, but comparing mind is awfully useful. You know, oh, look, this feels better than that. That's the essence of how you make progress, is not comparing in terms of, you know, envious objects and so forth, but what's the difference between this mind state and that mind state, and what's the effect of this action and the effect of that one? And eventually then the steadiness and clarity of a concentrated mind, it can be applied to momentary concentration, where you really deeply are with the beginning and the ending and the nature of each experience, each moment of experience. And this is how we eventually gain these liberating insights that can uproot the roots of suffering that really can't be reached in any other way, even by very strong one-pointed absorption. You need to come out a little bit and begin to see how things are operating and apply concentration in that way. So this wisdom or discernment, it's often expressed in Buddhist teachings as deepening insight into what are called the three characteristics of experience. And I know you had a whole series on this in the winter, and you missed the anatta part, so I'm going to fill in some of that today and review a little bit of that. So these three characteristics, you'll hear these Pali words a lot, so I'll just mention them again. Anicca, it's usually translated as impermanence or inconstancy. Dukkha, the suffering, unreliability, stress. And anatta, not self, anatta, anatta. So directly experiencing these characteristics are among the most profound insights of insight meditation. And that means that they might sound like bad news, but they're not actually inherently bad news. They're actually the essence of wisdom, and the way to freedom is learning to work skillfully with what we learn to discern about these aspects of experience. So anicca. So we know superficially, everyone would say things don't last, right? We know that. But this remains an intellectual view. It doesn't really affect how we react when big things change. You know, you can know it's going to change, and then, oh, they mean me, they mean really, they mean my friends, my country, whatever it is that's suddenly changing in a way that is very disturbing, right? So, or also it doesn't make much of a dent in our habits of constantly struggling to get everything lined up the way we want it, and just with this subconscious understanding that it will stay put. Somehow there's a way to get it to line up and stay put. You know, it's very hard to learn to see through that. So in our practice, in our meditation practice, and even in our daily life practice, we're learning to really let our attention abide as much as possible for long periods of time with just the flow of mental and physical events. And our perception can then shift by itself from an orientation that's dwelling and holding on to our ideas about things into relaxing into this flowing process nature of experience. It's often compared to melting, right? Letting the ice of our various holdings turn into water in the sun of awareness, if you will. So it's about befriending this process nature of existence, having the faith that although this process of releasing layers and layers of inner mental and physical tension, psychophysical knots, it can be quite unpleasant at times and quite difficult, like frozen toes thawing out or quite painful, you know that it's leading in a good direction. And it's a necessary and, you know, eventually peaceful and delightful part of this practice. The more we relax into direct sensory contact with less of the conceptual overlay that's always going on in our minds, actually the less thingness we find in anything, right? So it's kind of the subjective analog of looking with an electron microscope. Even the rocks are dancing if you look at it closely enough. So seeing in this way promotes a change in how we relate just to jump back up to a different level of metaphor altogether, how we relate to making big deals out of what happens, for example. So I think of practice as learning to make molehills out of mountains, right? And that's so the opposite of what our whole social conversational complaining conventions are. You know, you get a flat tire, you make a big story out of it and complain to everybody about it. It's not our tendency to want to just say, yeah, you know, that happened. But, you know, this is the direction that practice is going in. So we learn to see at different levels that these artificially, conceptually compounded nature of things, of some experiences, makes them more overwhelming when they're taken as a whole. And by learning to see that they're actually composite and composed of different things that are constantly arising and passing and changing, then it's much easier to work with. So you can deconstruct an episode of strong emotional upset about something into more manageable parts. You know, there's bodily sensation, there's the thoughts and stories and images that are going with it, there's, you know, what is the particular thing that makes anger different from fear? Where does it feel different in your body? And if you can transition to looking at it that way instead of continuing to let it all glom together as this thing that seems terrible and feels terrible and is totally unworkable. So I often think in terms of de-chunking experience. So when I'm thinking of the future, if I think of something, oh, everything I have to do next year, or, you know, the next 4 years of some administration or something like that, it's very hard to think of. But if you just realize, no, you're going to get up and brush your teeth and take a shower, and you can even break that down, and you might meet somebody that you can either be nice to or mean to, or you might have a chance to say something or not, and it's all just going to unfold one little step at a time, and in that way it's much more manageable. And then at a smaller level, if you slow down and move closer to something like pain, you know, get beneath the idea of pain. I know you've all know this and have worked with this. It dissolves into vibrational energies that are much surprisingly easier to be with than if we continue to stay with this whole idea, conceptual level of it. So not to trivialize the difficulty of some of the encounters with impermanence that we all have. It's, you know, big stuff happens. But the more we practice with the small stuff, some important learning is going on. So I have a lot of confidence that I've gained from the practice that no matter what happens, my mind is getting trained to go in the direction of opening up and relaxing and looking into it and breaking it down rather than sticking with this belief that this cannot happen, I have to make this stop, and tensing up and fighting. So I just have a lot of confidence that, okay, I've trained myself in many, many small matters to go that way, and I've seen a few big ways where, yes, that's what comes to mind now. So that's a big element of faith for me. So this is some thoughts about wisdom as it comes out of getting more familiar with this feature of anicca. So turning to dukkha, this word that you all know, what is it? What causes it? How can it be brought to an end? It follows on really from the insight into anicca, because the Dharma teaches that suffering comes from staking our hopes for our well-being on the inherently unreliable. We do that over and over again. And in that way, there used to be a book, and there still is, a book by Alan Watts called The Wisdom of Anxiety. You know, you don't think of that very often, but anxiety is a red flag. It's a form of dukkha that says you're staking your well-being on something that is unstable. And that gives you a feeling of anxiety. Can you use that as a sort of a guide, a guardrail to where, what am I needing to happen or needing to not happen? You know, that's just not the right place to stake my well-being. So in this way, suffering is a guide. It's important to recall that this characteristic is not, it's not to be interpreted as a grim, nihilistic kind of thing, all of life is suffering. It's in the context of the Four Noble Truths, which is another way to look at the essence of wisdom, that there is suffering, you know, and we can step out of denial with regard to that, and we can discern what the causes of suffering are, And then we can work with those and eventually reach the cessation of suffering. And there's actually a well-known path of practice to do that. So this is good news. It's joyful and hopeful and encouraging. So just to review a little bit of what the Buddha's view of how suffering works might be. So the Buddha identified, and I find this very satisfying in this whole tradition. It keeps me with it. The Buddha identified suffering as the ultimate problem of human beings. That's what we're all trying to get at every which way that we're getting at it, is how not to suffer. We're all aware to some degree of death, illness, old age, loss, misfortune, meaninglessness, unpleasant sensations, lack of perfect control over what happens, right? All that happens all the time. So how we usually work with those things is that we constantly try to control the circumstances and events in the world. And we put all our energy and attention there, and we don't notice that this is impossible in a lasting way because we haven't seen really the deep, ever-moving nature of things. And we don't notice that it comes at a very high cost to ourselves of stress, anxiety, and frustration because it doesn't work. And we don't realize the extent to which the subjective experience that we call suffering is actually something that arises from within in the way that we react to these unavoidable pains and surprises of life. In fact, suffering begins at the moment that we begin to crave and cling or resist based on our ideas of how things should be or could be or shouldn't be. There's some moment of sensory contact, and then right away, oh, that shouldn't, nope, don't like that, and we start to fight with it or hang on to it, try to make it behave the way we want it to. And right then, it's so powerful to see this little subtle shift between something's kind of unpleasant, and you know it's unpleasant, and you jump off into that world of, I'm going to do something about it and fix it and make it stop. Right there is where that strain, that extra stress comes in. We're not saying you never try to change things, but you can change things being aware that it has some chance of working out and some chance of not working out, and you'll do your best. But when you get that grip, it has to be my way, that's when suffering begins. So what happens when we take this move into clinging and craving? It begins to tie us literally in knots. We hold our breath. Our energy and our attention get sucked in to these habit-based reactivities, and we quit looking for fresh and clear information about the situation. And then this is normally unconscious process. We get all kinds of physical tensions. We get disconnected between our mind and our body. We start speaking and acting out in ways that are, you know, perceived as harmful by other people, and then it triggers the same process in them, and you know, there's the world, right? Everybody reacting against what everybody else is doing. So as we cultivate wisdom in working with all this, the tasks are that we gradually cultivate awareness of these processes that I just described. We allow the actual stress of that clinging and aversion moment. We have to allow that to be felt as such. We have to open to the wisdom of non-denial. Open to turn towards, get the sense for what it feels to be pushed around by having to change, have to do this, have to change it. Oh, feel that's actually a pushing kind of pressure, maybe in the middle of your back, sort of, I have to fix all this. Stop, turn around, and face it, you know. And feel that there's a pressure involved in that that's actually unpleasant, that's coming from within, from this desire to make it change. And then we begin to let go of that enough to have some moments of perceiving, oh, it's okay, if I let go of that, it feels better. And then you have this discernment that, oh, this feels better and that feels worse, and you just have to see that over and over and over and over and over again. And it eventually deepens into this real habit of discerning when you're moving toward more suffering and when you're moving toward less suffering. So the less tightly we grip onto experience like that, the more we just go with the flow, as they used to say. Not to say that you're not influencing it, but you're surfing with it and you know, influencing it, harmonizing with it, doing what you can with it, staying aware of what's happening. We begin to have this insight that really we aren't separate from these changing phenomena. We're not this alienated, separate little thing, always flailing to control the big world out there, you know. But we're really totally and inseparably a part of this lawful flow of all of nature. We're made out of the stuff that everything else is made out of. We're flowing with it. And everything is lawful in that it unfolds from conditions. If you do things out of tension, you'll get tension. If you do things out of openness, you'll get the feeling of openness and freedom. And this turns out to include this potential for a lawful path to the end of suffering, all the way to the end of suffering. So this leads us to that third characteristic, the characteristic of anatta, which is usually translated more correctly as not self, sometimes no self. But it's very interesting to understand how to take this teaching. A lot of people hear that and it's so unintuitive, it just doesn't make any sense at all. So first of all, the most important thing to understand is that explicitly this is not supposed to be taken as a metaphysical teaching that about how things are, you know, whether there are or aren't entities and so forth, and that you go off and argue with your friends about and get into big philosophical debates. The Buddha was very explicitly kind of laughing at the people of his time who spent all their time arguing, like how many angels can dance on the head of the pin, and is the self this or that or the other, and, you know, no. Come into the present moment and just pay attention to what's causing suffering and what isn't. There's a wonderful sutta, one of my favorites, in the Majjhima Nikaya number 2, called the Sutta on Wise Attention, where he explicitly talks about people getting lost in what he calls the thicket of views, the thicket of opinions, views about yourself. And it's partly, there's two meanings of view here. There's opinion, where, you know, the different sects are philosophically arguing with each other. And then there's this more subtle view that we have, that's where we're just all the time completely caught up in our own biographical obsessions. You know, that ongoing narrator in the back of your mind that's just talking about yourself all the time, right? And so he talks about people who are always obsessed with asking themselves, who am I? Who was I? Who will I be? Having been this, what will I be? This is kind of in the context of the multiple lifetimes teaching, but we ask ourselves that all the time. Who am I? Who was I? What was that? What am I going to be? What do they think I am? What, you know, all that obsession, that level of obsession, not helpful. Drop that whole subject and come back to, this is suffering, this is not suffering. This is the cause of suffering, this is how to work with suffering, this is the path. So, and just not as an idea, but as, oh, right now. So, you know, you can notice when you get into a philosophical argument with somebody, if you drop back into that perspective of the Four Noble Truths, you're all up in your head and you're very tense and you're kind of tending to shout at each other. That is suffering. You know, that's not the way to the answer, figuring out the answer of, you know, these metaphysical questions. But this is suffering right now, right? And if the more you're caught up in wondering about, oh, does everybody like me? Who am I? I'm such a bad person. Oh, how did I get to be such a bad person? Wait, is that continuing along that train of thought? Is that suffering or is that not suffering? Compared to, say, going back to feeling your breath, feel your feet on the ground, look around, look at the sun, you know, which is more or less suffering. So that's the advice around wise attention. So we need to approach these teachings around this characteristic in terms of what we're doing with our intention. We're not arguing and speculating. We're not totally lost. One of my teachers, Joseph Goldstein, used to call this was am will be, you know, like it's somebody's name, was am will be. You know, I'm talking about I was, I am, I will be. And you hear yourself just nya-nya-nya-nya-nya about that in the back of the mind all the time. So you just notice how caught up are you in that, You can't, you know, it's not good to just try to make it stop. It's going to go on. But how caught up are you in it? How much of your energy are you putting in it? And then we're turning to the processes of trying to keep something of this phenomenological point of view. Oh, this is a phenomenon that this chatter is going on, right? Catch it in the act and learn to see through the deeper motivations that keep all that stuff going. So as we do this, we discover this great variety of self-images, self-words, stories, sensory impressions. I remember once I very clearly on retreat, it's like the mind was showing me this, an image of a relative came up, and the whole feeling of the constellation of who I was in relation to that person, you know, came up, kind of childish and kind of, I don't know, different things. And then a different situation came to mind, just an image of a different situation. I could feel my body where I felt more empowered and, you know, adult. I could feel my whole body straightening up and like, oh yeah, whew, you know. I remembered when I used to go home for the holidays when my parents were still alive, I'd kind of regress, you know, and then there'd be this moment at the end after New Year's when I was walking onto the airplane by myself. It was like taking off a coat, like, oh, I'm an adult again. You know? So you're so many different people, you know, you're different in every situation, you have all these moods. So it's so interesting. This is what's meant by this anatta. There's a definition that the Buddha was contrasting his teaching with of what an atta is. It's this supposed to be this essence or core of any particular thing that's residing permanently in the object. That's the owner and the controller and the essential recipient of experience and the agent of action, right? Now this does, if you really look at how you feel about yourself, yeah, you know, I'm in there, that's it. I'm the one that things happen to. I'm the one who does things. So that is our common sense view that we're coming from. But it's so wrapped up in language, in our habitual use of language and our habitual energy pattern of focusing in that way. It's kind of like, you know, something that's just, well, it's like a clenched fist, you know. You open it up and there wasn't anything there, but the clenching makes it seem like there's something there. But the nothing there is really freeing, because then you just, you know, you can focus on what's wholesome and what's unwholesome, not what's me and what's not me. You know, it frees you up to change. It can be awfully hard to change because we're, ooh, this is not who I am. I'm not a person who goes dancing, you know. Something like that. Oh, well, you could be. Try it. You know? So it's really getting comfortable with being a fluid process of coherent functioning instead of some fixed thing that has fixed properties. So it's very helpful in doing this to begin to catch this activity, to see selfing in a way as an activity. It sometimes is called eyeing, in the suttas, eyeing, meing, and mining, making things. This is mine, this is me, I do this. So if you can catch that in the act, by seeing how in our thinking process we are always glomming our experience onto this hypothetical entity and reinforcing that view of things, you can begin to see what effect that has. You know, so some silly things. Ads and entertainment know all about this, right? I've been looking at new cars recently. And as long as I'm thinking, well, let's see, it gets this mile per gallon and so forth, it's all very neutral. But when my mind shifts into picturing myself being the sort of person who has such a cute little car, you know, then there's a whole emotional attachment to, well, okay, so that one's more expensive, but I was so cute in that one, you know. So that's silly, but just, you know, how that, it's not silly, it happens, how advertising gets you to get your self-image in there. It's got emotional juice in it, you know. So how does this selfing activity lead to suffering? It's like these thoughts of I, me, and mine, they're like the nexus of all our worries. You know, they connect very deeply to our whole survival instinct, which is one of the very hardest, deepest layers to work with. And once our own once our well-being potential seems to be at stake, even if it's around what car you thought you wanted and they're out of that one or something, then emotions. That opens the window for some emotional juice to come in. It narrows our perspective, we lose the wisdom perspective, and we jump on the train of all the associated thoughts, deeply subliminally, that we have with what it means to be threatened in our survival level somehow. So I heard this wonderful phrase from another teacher on retreat. Somebody described the self as the narrative center of gravity. And I really like that, because all your narrative that's going on in the back of your mind is about yourself. And once you've lost that meditative, mindful perspective, you have something like a perception comes up. It triggers all these associations. You jump out of the world of mindfulness into the whole little tinker toy in your mind, and then there's this center of gravity that's all about me and mine, and it proliferates down there to where the silliest things suddenly are, you know, why do I care whether last night they were supposed to deliver a chair for me at 4 o'clock and they came at 6 o'clock? You know, I was there all evening. Why would that be of any concern? This whole little thing about they're taking advantage of me, you know, they're going to, I don't know, it just proliferates into irrational thoughts of, you know, they are lazy, they're not doing what they should do, the whole world won't do what it should do, you know. And right away, there's just some extra stress around what's a completely trivial event, because you let it take that pathway into that center of gravity that goes all the way down to stuff that has nothing to do with what just happened. Right? Just in driving here, I was driving along and before I tell the story, I just want to say that the Buddha's, this is a whole different talk that I'm not going to get into tonight, but the Buddha's understanding of what is ourself is taught in terms of the five aggregates. I don't know if you've heard that term, but it's five kinds of stuff that we tend to glom onto and identify with. And those are like bodily sensations, this feeling tone of pleasant, unpleasant, perception, which is what I want to talk about, the different mental formations that arise, that's the whole network, the web of associations that you have with things and what arises out of that. And then consciousness itself, being the knower, being the one that things are happening to. Okay, so perception is very interesting, because perception is so often, perception just means that something, a fresh sensory input that you had, kind of gets a hit in the database of all of your words and memories and everything. It's a recognized thing. You know, so I look out there, chair. Okay, that bing, that's a perception. And it can stop there. But a lot of perceptions, if you're kind of not very mindful, they throw you into this web. They kind of resonate, chair not particularly, but something else kind of resonates with all of the associations that it has with it. And pretty soon, it's like it jiggles that center of gravity in the middle of the web, and pretty soon you're down there with your self-concerns. And the whole world is now about you and your problems again instead of, you know. So anyway, I was driving here, good example. I had the perception that the person in the car in front of me had dark skin. You can't help perception. Perception is just, you saw it. It hit your database. That word popped up. That was the end of the story, except that I happened to be thinking about this topic this evening. But, you know, that right away, that then would hit normally a whole set of associations that we have with that. Right, especially these days. Oh, that's a big emotional thing that's just right there ready to, you know, a lot of feelings flying around about all that right now. So that's right there ready to have to derail you from the awareness that that completely irrelevant and benign and perhaps even incorrect perception popped up, right? So perception then throws you into all the stuff that's associated with that, which pretty quickly makes its way into the emotional terrain of the self. And, you know, oh, I shouldn't have that perception, for example. Or they would hate me if they knew I had that perception. Completely silly thoughts. But, you know, I don't know, the whole issue, you know what the issue is. The whole issue just comes up, and however you feel about it, and pretty soon you've spent an hour and a half thinking about the election and all this kind of stuff. All because of, you know, the person in front of you appeared to look a little the way they look, or their car was blue or whatever. It just nothing, you know, right? So that's how it's so important to be mindful of when some sensory event has lit up your conceptual network, right? Because then pretty soon your whole self, me and my problems and the world, me and the world, the world's problems, that whole story is going to begin to consume your mind. So just a few other things about how this selfing activity relates to suffering. Basically, it hijacks your attention and it takes it away from what would be more wise ways to attend to things. So you say you have a little pain in your back while you're sitting, right? If you notice that, then you have the opportunity to turn to deconstructing it into vibration or moving or whatever's appropriate. If you don't notice it, it's going to be your leg. Oh, this always happens. My leg. You know, the next thing you know, you're worrying about whether it's going to do some damage, which is an appropriate thing to discern, but not to worry about. You try to discern it, and then you either move or don't. But continuing to obsess on it and, you know, oh, I didn't get my health insurance lined up. What am I going to do? And then you're off the track, and you've just lost an opportunity to work with it skillfully. It also keeps us, it's very important to see in terms of this whole reactive layer that I would call blame and shame and guilt and shame over things. That's a really clear way to see how self is at the heart of a lot of suffering. Say you made a mistake, like say you didn't show up when you were supposed to give a Dharma talk or something like that, and you had your reasons. And so how much time do you spend dwelling on, oh, I that happened, oh, I did it, I'm a bad person, they're going to hate me, and so forth. Fortunately, I didn't spend much time on that. But, you know, every moment that you spend in that way just pumps stress chemicals into your body, makes you think less clearly. You know, it's taking resources away from, you could think, well, let's see, you know, how did I actually manage to mess that up, and how could I make sure I don't mess it up again? You know, so it's so skillful to be oriented toward the future. You can learn from your mistakes. But if you, the more personally you take them and make them about how you're a bad person, instead of, okay, this did actually happen for a series of reasons. What were they? Where was it that I wasn't mindful, or that I, you know, put something in the wrong place or something like that? Where did that happen? And so that I can, you know, just do the right thing next time. So it can be straightforward, or it can be a cause of a lot of suffering. Also, there's a tendency when, if we strongly keep reinforcing this idea of control, that we're in control, that we ought to be able to make things happen, we get to be in this state of kind of hyper-responsibility where we don't trust anybody else to do anything, we have to do everything ourselves. You know, that begins to be very wearing. I wanted to read you this paragraph from a book I really enjoyed about, if I have it here. Oh, I thought I had it. Yeah. It's from a book called The Healing Spirit by Paul Fleischman, who's a Vipassana teacher and a psychologist. He's talking about release, which is another term for increasing freedom. He says, release matures into the capacity to resolve ambivalence, to relinquish the endless possibilities of other choices and improved safety, to sleep at night because the day is done, to stand by what has been accomplished. To seek enlightenment or higher human goals, one must be able to focus, concentrate, and brush aside the chaff. People who can find no release complain, everything is up to me. Without me, everything would fall apart. I can't leave anything to anyone else or just let it go. I don't know if you recognize any of this little strain in you or in someone you know. But when release is found, it is linked to a faith in the continuity of life and in the constructive, reliable presence of other people, other places, and other times. It ripens into a sense of an adequate, ample portion for one's own existence, coupled to the self-replenishing fountain of creation. There follows the capacity to float on tiredness, darkness, and sleep with confidence in both one's own and others' dawn. From here, it is one step to pass into death with faith. So I just think that's a beautiful description of, you know, the way in which this self-centered grip of trying to control everything can begin to relax into a trust in the whole situation, to not necessarily be just what you would want, but to be what it is, following its own natural unfolding, you know, and following your own response to it. So this thing of making a self also applies to othering, right? Attributing a self to other people. So blaming other people. One of my favorite old Zen stories is about the rowboat. I don't know if you know that story, but somebody's on a lake and he's in a boat and this other boat is coming like it's going to crash into his boat. And he said, "What are you doing, you idiot? You're going to crash into my boat, don't you see?" And he's getting more and more and more upset about, "Don't you see? You're coming, you're going to crash right into me." And then when it gets close enough, there's nobody in it. It's just an empty rowboat. And so the point is, immediately you would just drop all that blame and like, oh, you know, it's an empty rowboat. So the analogy for that is, as we really begin to see into, deeply into how things just arise out of conditions in our own minds. You know, if you forgot to do something, you forgot. You know, it's not like you could have done, that did not arise. The thought of doing that did not arise. And there's nothing you can do about that. And as you see that in yourself, you begin to be a little more forgiving of other people who, you know, the thought did not occur to them. They simply did not put it together that way. They don't have the same information structure in their mind that you do. You know, they're going on entirely different information, which is happening a lot these days. And so you kind of see that this is the lawful nature of what it is to have a human mind unfolding in its imperfect way. Everybody's imperfect by everybody else's point of view, because the same things don't occur in the same order at the same time. And, you know, really understanding, it's hard to get that down to the emotional level, but beginning to understand that that is the way things are helps, you know. It helps with the side that wants to turn toward more ease and compassion and less, you know, how could you be such an idiot view about this stuff. So I just want to say a few words, have a little more time here, about the compatibility of this sometimes hard to understand teaching about not self with a Western psychological view of healthy self and healthy, you know, what is a healthy self? So there's a quote from the famous Zen master Dogen: "To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things," which, as I understand it, you know, you really look at yourself. You see this idea of self. You see what it's made of. The more you make peace with it, the less obsessed you are with yourself. There's not so much of this twisting around to look at yourself and being self-conscious and self-critical and self-concerned and self-centered. The more you've really worked through your issues and worked through your stuff, work through some of these deeper insights that we get in Dharma practice, then you can kind of forget yourself, and then you can just be what's happening. Be there, be with other people, be present, right? So, but also I've really learned a lot from this what I think of as the empathetic stance of psychology. The stance is needed in a way that I at least used to somehow mishear the Buddhist teachings. You know, as if you were having a strong emotion, you were just supposed to somehow note it away or push it away, or, you know, say, well, it's just an emotion. And that wasn't really getting at the strength of some of these things, you know. So I found it really, really helpful to, and Buddhism does teach this through self-compassion. It's not truly incompatible. It just depends on, you know, how you read it or how you hear it. So we so want some of these difficult, afflictive emotions to go away. It plays right into our own sense of, well, I'll just deny it. You know, I'm a Buddhist. I don't get angry. you know, something like that. And that can be not at all skillful. It's really hard to learn what it means to open to some of these deep wounding that a lot of us have in a way that maintains, you know, from Buddhism we bring this beautiful perspective of maintaining a present moment awareness and a sense of who you are as your most mature and adult process in the present. And then you can have this compassion for those parts of you that are stuck in some kind of, you know, thing that hasn't fully been worked through or seen or understood. And so this combination of presence and compassion for, you know, and there are a lot of skillful means out there for working with maybe, you know, some traumatic memories or with something that's happened to you or just the ordinary everyday stuff of how through your whole life maybe you never really got to be yourself. You know, you spent your whole life pleasing other people, and that really builds up a lot of deep grief and strain that can be very difficult to be with. And so finding this technique for not being ashamed of that and not denying that, but letting that come forward and be felt compassionately, but also not totally identifying with it so that you're not just living from that perspective as you, you know, so that it doesn't slide into totally having that perspective, then that's more like self-pity, not self-compassion, if you feel any difference between those two words. So it's very interesting working with this way of giving compassion to oneself. And of course, for me, it's been important to make free use of, you know, thinking about myself and me. And, you know, it's so different to look at, now, what do I really think? What's my view here versus what am I just saying to please other people? You know, so it's important not to take this teaching to mean that there's anything wrong with that level of conventional, ordinary psychological exploration, because it's really necessary. So, in this experience of trusting your own integrity more and less self-conscious, you become less burdened by inner conflicts, repression, denial. You're not sort of going around fighting a rear guard action of what, oh dear, what might I say if I were just myself, you know, or what, I don't know, what might come up or what emotional tantrums might burst forth. You kind of relieve the pressure of a lot of that by skillfully working through it. Then you can be less self-conscious, right? Then you're more free to just be, because there's less inner conflict and turmoil. That's, you're not twisting around looking at yourself, trying to manage and control yourself all the time. And then you're freer to offer the same spacious acceptance to other people. You know, you can be there with other people as they work through their processes, understanding how this is and what it's like to work through it. The poet Mary Oliver has a beautiful poem called To Begin With the Sweet Grass. I don't have time to read the whole thing, but the last line of it is kind of a riff on the Dogen quote that I read, where she says, love yourself, then forget it, then love the world. It's a beautiful poem. So, just closing up here a little bit, with the help of these three insights, we go discerning our way along, right? Navigating by the Four Noble Truths, we keep balancing all these faculties. We balance faith, wisdom, effort, and concentration are kind of balanced. Mindfulness is always present. There's a line from the Buddha I like. For one who is concentrated, there is no need to intend, may I know and see things as they really are. It is a natural law for one with a concentrated mind to know and see things as they really are. So this points to the work to develop out of faith, to do the work, the effort, to develop mindfulness, to develop concentration, and then just trust that wisdom will arise. It's a natural law. And then wisdom and faith continue to kind of interpenetrate, because faith becomes more and more based on direct knowledge. And then wisdom has a quality of faith in it, because it's not this thing that you have. It's this ongoing, you know, there's always the next step. And so you have this faith that wisdom is going to be there for you to discern what you need to do next, and that this way of life is ultimately trustable. Not to provide everything you want, but to not suffer from what happens. It's interesting to get this distinction. What is it that we're trusting? We're not trusting that somehow magically everything is going to be the way we imagine it needs to be. But we can learn to trust that we can deal with it, you know, be with it, not contribute to more harm, and not suffer so much from it. For most of us, this happens very gradually. I love this metaphor in the suttas of the rotting rope, where a rope is a ship is halfway on the beach and there's a rope that's under the water, and every year a little bit of it rots away, a little bit rots away, and then you pick it up and it's broken. You know, but you might not notice which strands of your attachment to things are being worked through at different times. So the real effect of growing wisdom, deepening wisdom, it's often noticed, you know, looking back on noticing, oh, that doesn't happen anymore, right? I've had a long struggle with envy in a particular situation. And, you know, it's just interesting to notice if a friend gets, you know, some promotion that, you know, I would have envied, and envy doesn't arise. A kind of happiness for her arises. And wow, that's different. It's like this clutching thing that used to happen does not happen. Great. And you can notice that there's still some degree of brightness of mind and interest, even while you're sleepy and grumpy. You know, these moods can go on. It's not like you're not grumpy anymore, not lazy, not sleepy, not watching TV or whatever, but, you know, some little thing, some little part of the mind is still awake saying, well, yeah, this is going on. You know, I wonder how this is going to change. You know, you just kind of, you have that awareness more often. Or, you know, reading the news these days, the mind wants to turn to despair, wants to turn to anger very quickly. But it doesn't get as far as it used to before some wiser, you know, notice, oh, this is extremely suffering to go there, to go to proliferating what might happen, what ought to happen. Ah, it can't happen. Wait, this is too much suffering. So steadying your confidence, relocating your confidence on your own wholesome intentions. You know, that's the part that we have control over. What are we putting into the world? Resteadying your confidence there, finding some element of this to open to compassionately, you know, some yourself, if nothing else, something you can feel compassion for. And then the equanimity of a vast perspective on change. And, you know, it's a silly, but it cheers me up to think of some of the great spiritual people in the history of the world who have lived in really terrible times. You know, it doesn't mean, whatever's happening in the world doesn't mean that you can't go all the way in that context to liberation and to being a great light for the rest of the world. You know, I like to think of like Rumi escaped from Genghis Khan when he was a child and was driven to Turkey from Iraq or wherever he was born, for example. And I like to read the Chinese Tang poets who were early kind of Buddhist influence. And they lived in a time of this terrible rebellion that was tearing apart all of China. And, you know, wonderful little poems about how they went back to their house in the woods and, you know, learned how to live there. And they'd go back and forth to court, and then they'd get fed up with what was going on at court and go back to their little thatch in the woods. And I don't know, it's just inspiring to me to think this has been going on for so long. You know, the Buddha was not able to prevent a war between his kinsmen over water rights. He tried, but, you know, they wouldn't listen. But that didn't prevent him from becoming, you know, this huge light that lights our lives to this day. So anyway, these are some things that I mean by the equanimity of a big perspective on what's happening. So we have these faculties, just the end of the faculties series here, that culminate in wisdom. And they work together to really free the mind and the heart. And I just want to close with a passage from the suttas that's been very inspiring for me for 20 years, ever since I started this. Puts it in perspective. This holy life doesn't have as its reward gain, offerings, and fame. Doesn't have as its reward consummation of virtue. Doesn't have as its reward consummation of concentration. Doesn't have as its reward knowledge and vision, but the unshakable deliverance of mind, the sure heart's release. This is the purpose of the holy life, its heartwood and its end.
Thank you.